Okay.
Full disclosure. Wrong piece of classical music. Shoot.
So, full disclosure.
Full disclosure.
Melissa Tucker is one of my besties.
What? That's
what people should know, like right off the bat, like before we start talking. Oh, I hate the way I said that. That is something that people should know right off the bat, because I'm very excited to talk to you and there's some important points I want to hit, but full disclosure.
Full disclosure.
You're one of my besties.
Oh, I love my goodness. Full disclosure. Full disclosure.
Full disclosure.
I interrupted you. That might happen on this. I'm going to try not to. It's totally mutual.
It's probably more complicated than that.
I first met Melissa Tucker over a plate of Thai food while our friend was in his theology class. And during that time, we decided to co-lead a quote-unquote mission trip from the Nazarene University down to Costa Rica together. On that mission trip, yes, we painted a church. Yes, I preached a couple sermons. We had vacation Bible school for kids. We met with a local theologian at the seminary to discuss colonialism and Jubilee economics and new voices in Costa Rican indigenous theology. You know, like you do. It was a really transformative time for some of the people who participated, and it was a transformative time for me. That was over 20 years ago. Today, Melissa's going to take us on a slightly different trip and walk us through life living on the borderlands. Metaphorically, as she navigates being an ordained woman in a conservative denomination, and literally as she pastors a suburban church in San Diego, not too far from the Mexican border, where they're affected very much by immigration issues. But first, let me remind you to visit us at theheartburn.net, leave us a voice message for future episodes, and it is the truth, if you go to Etsy and type in Doug Thy Neighbor, you will be able to see one of the Heartburn official t-shirts. There are a number of other heart-themed t-shirts and accessories, accoutrements, if you will, for your purchasing pleasure that will help support this podcast. And of course, the magic words for us right now are review and subscribe. Please take less than 5 minutes just to subscribe to this. Again, you can change your mind in the future about that. And leave a quick review. It's great feedback for us, but it also helps other people discover us and keeps us in circulation. Let's hop right in to my conversation with the inimitable Reverend Melissa Tucker.
Well, one of the things that we just keep talking about is really like every life has some moment of being precarious, like where you're caught between two different things, where there's multiple pressures coming at you from different angles. And it's usually people's passion or what makes their heart burn that gets them through and committed to doing precisely what they're doing and how they commit to how they're doing it, how they go about it. And I can't help but think about you. And here you are, you live in a culture war era, and there's lots of different things being said. But at the end of the day, you are a woman.
Yes.
You are a Nazarene pastor.
This is
you
true.
You are bilingual.
Sí, claro.
You live in a city that is on the border with Mexico.
Yes.
You care about immigration issues.
Mm-hmm.
You are in a position that really is like the perfect juxtaposition where things get complicated for people who live in an era of the culture wars. And what I don't want to really pose for you is like what it's like for you to be in opposition with your denomination or your church structures, because I think that that's too limiting to what the real struggle is, that it's a cultural issue. And so let's just start. And how long have you been ordained?
So I got ordained in 2016. So, last month would make that 3 years. Yeah.
When I was at Point Loma Nazarene University, there was literally one student that was a woman in the religion department. It was just unthinkable. Yeah. So that journey, did you constantly bump your head up against patriarchy? Was it just a frustration? And how'd you live it? What'd you do with it?
Yeah, thank you for asking that. To sort of kind of add on and add a little more context to the convo here.
Context.
The Church of the Nazarene, like a lot of American denominations, is not very old. It's just over about one century old. It started in 1895 as a mission to the poor in what is now the Skid Row area of Los Angeles. Later, it would join together with a number of other small denominations to form the Pentecostal Church of the Nazarene, not to be confused with Pentecostalism that sprung out of like the Azusa Street revivals, also out of Los Angeles. This new denomination of 1905, the Church of the Nazarene, had an emphasis on holiness, and at that time, about 25% of its preachers, actual active preachers, were women. The mid-20th century came with a lot of social change, and with it, a lot of different new theologies. Leery of a lot of the more liberal theologies, the Church of the Nazarene veered towards the more conservative, more traditional values and theology. It also veered away from some of its social ministry, and less women continued to fill the pulpit. To this date, there's only about 4% women that are ordained ministry in the Church of the Nazarene. Melissa Tucker is one of them.
This is the denomination in which I was raised. There was never any rhetoric anti-women. I never heard anything that would prevent women, or me particularly, from going into ministry. There wasn't like a tremendous amount of like rally around women being in ministry, but it wasn't negative or anti. And if those voices were, if there were voices speaking that would get kind of squashed. And I grew up in a minister's home, so I would hear about, you know, some of the conversations around the church board table and things like that. So all that to say, while women being ministers was certainly open to me, it was not encouraged. It was nothing I saw. That's the problem for me, is that I never really had a retreat speaker who was a woman, much less a pastor on a staff who was a woman, or a camp speaker who was a woman. And the only time I really saw women speaking or taking up pastoral authority was at a women's ministry event where I would be invited as like a teen girl. And so my imagination was really limited. And that is such a sad state of affairs to be in, when the denomination was founded with a quarter of the founding members, or a quarter of the preaching positions being held by women at the start of the denomination at the turn of the century, at the end of the 1800s. And so to have gone from a quarter of the preaching posts being held by women to less than 4% now is such tremendous and terrible regression, that even though we have quite a robust set of biblical interpretive statements, doctrinal statements that would absolutely not just like be okay with women in ministry, but would honor and like encourage that, it's not being lived out in practice. So what we, you know, come to is that greater societal influences, patriarchy, have certainly crept in and done their damaging work and their limiting work. So where I found myself, you know, over the course of my 20s in navigating my career and leaving education, elementary education, moving into ministry work, really feeling that was actually the pathway I was really to be on, was that I was not only feeling that it was more difficult to advance than my male contemporaries and to get through my ordination process, but also there are some other factors that we could put in here that I think have everything to do with me being female, is that I'm not married and I don't have children and I don't have someone that comes with me into the interview and sits with me, which is a requirement if you're married in my denomination. Not that your spouse is in ministry, but that they go to your interview with you. And I think that there was a greater skepticism about me and my fitness for ministry without having this nuclear family that I'm also living into. But sadly, what I think is happening, not having a man that authorizes my existence and to sort of, you know, someone to quote, keep me in check, is how I've interpreted the way that I have felt in the way that you feel these things when you're not on the team, that you're not on the team.
I mean, I have a lot of friends that would hear that and just say, hey, there's so many denominations that are so progressive. Why would you go to the trouble of sticking with this particular denomination to go through this? I have answers of my own, but what are yours?
It's a really, really good question. And one that I'd be lying if I said that I hadn't asked myself multiple times. I need to continue to ask myself because it keeps me cognizant and aware of the reasons why I'm choosing to be a part of this. And why, more than choosing to, why I'm continuing to say yes to what feels like an invitation to stay. So at the very most fundamental level, I'm in the Nazarene church and pursued the step of becoming clergy because it was in response to what I felt like at the most core level God was asking me to do with my life and my time and my energy. And I was able to say yes, in large part because these are the people that raised me. And this denomination, and to walk away from it, I don't think would be ungrateful or unfaithful by any means. But this connection to the Church of the Nazarene is sort of like, it's an identifying piece. It's almost like an ethnicity, right? There's a tribe, there's people that come along with this, and a language and a history, stories, memories, connections that are really significant to me. And because the work of Christian ministry involves, it certainly includes lots and lots of things, but it involves like discipleship, which is how do we continue to live in the way of Jesus Christ? How do we study his life and pattern our lives after his life is so well best done in community with people that are consistently a part of your life, that are going to track with you, that are going to be bold enough to call you out, loving enough to bring you soup when you're sick and take care of your kids. Like it feels like in a macro sense, I'm continuing to like disciple myself and disciple others within this consistent community of people who do some great things. I mean, there are the emphasis, at least at the beginning, but certainly that people continue to push for, that the church continue to prioritize care to the poor, ministry to the poor, to balance out the injustices of the world, is significant enough to keep me in. That the Church of the Nazarene sort of advocates this via media, this middle way, not going to extremes, but constantly asking, how do we take the best of different sides and pull that to the middle? How do we listen well to different voices? Has become, as I've gotten older, something I really appreciate about this denomination. And it does gathering well. It does camps every year. And I just wrapped up being a part of an every 4 year gathering for all youth in Canada and the US. And those are formative experiences that certainly shaped me. And I could go on and on and on, but there's much about this denomination that I'm so much on board with, and a community of people that come with it. But also because I was raised in it, because I've taken the step to align myself with it even more formally, I do have voice within it, right? And a platform. And there are some things that need more work and need to be called out, and some things that need to die away. And those things don't change or be given their proper burial by outside voices that don't know that community and that language. And I'm not in it because I need to change it. I'm in it because I'm saying yes, and I love this community, but I love it so much that I'm also going to speak truth and ask it to be better where it needs to be better.
being part of an organized religion certainly is not the most popular thing to do right now. But for Melissa, it's a powerful thing. But not only does she literally have a pulpit, but she also has a shared story and ongoing relationships where people can help to shape each other's imagination, not just by talking, but by how they live together. Is Melissa helping, or is she part of the problem? Well, when we come back, I'll just let her keep talking, and you can decide for yourself. You're listening to The Heartburn.
I have good news, everybody. I'm actually going to be giving away a t-shirt, a tote bag, a mug, actually an item of your choice, anywhere from the Heartburn Podcast Collection or from Doug Thy Neighbor, the store on Etsy, where you can go to just at etsy.com/shop/Doug Thy Neighbor. All you have to review, any review that you give, just put in a little bit of information, click a star, and I'm going to be choosing one randomly selected, not based on your review, randomly selected review each week through August and into September, and you'll receive one item, again, either from the Heartburn Podcast Collection or from the Doug Thy Neighbor store. So don't forget to review. That's all you got to do. And then I will click on it and be in touch with you, and we will send those off to the winners, but you have to review to do it.
You're saying to me that one of the reasons for you to stay is precisely because it's creating a context for you to be of service to the poor. And frankly, it's going to make some of my friends scratch their heads and say, that's certainly not from the Church of the Nazarene. That's not what I expect. So what is it that you actually do in your ministry, and what is it about the church that actually makes ministry to the poor? And even that is going to raise some questions. The way I've said that is that ministry to the poor is a vague statement.
Sure.
But it also could include some rather condescending and disempowering sort of exercises too.
Oh, sure.
Why do you, as a smart, and I happen to know, since we already established one of my besties, as a really smart, educated woman with two master's degrees, able to like say, no, this is good quality, empowering, you know, liberation theology, you know, Marxist critiques, you know, okay, so talk to me. Why is this a good place for you to do ministry?
Yeah. And ministry too is, I'm glad that you reiterated what I said. I think, yeah, language is super important. Doing life with and among the poor, that Christian ministry would be done hand in hand with others, not to them. But yeah, the church's early emphasis, and really its reasons for beginning, was to say that the church continues to move away from certain populations, certain geographies, certain places, certain gatherings, and we're moving in. And I think that so to extrapolate that out, even from just talking about economics, it would be groups that are marginalized, people that don't seem to be welcome, like to move into those places. In fact, calling itself the Church of the Nazarene, which is referring to the city of Nazareth where Jesus is from. And the scriptures that say that what good could come from there? This Jesus guy from there. We don't expect anything good to come from them. And so the Church of the Nazarene being a place in theory in its beginnings that would say, we're gonna hang out with people And if the world doesn't expect much from them, watch out, because it should. My daily life is lived with my local people, and my community at my church, and certainly my connection to the Nazarene University here in my town, of people who are living into the really hard but life-giving and life-changing commands that come from Christ. So the teachings, the way of life of Jesus that continues to include, to always bring in, to always expand, not keep out, that is this consistent message and consistent witness. If you look at the life of Christ, there's not fear, and there's not drawing close in, but always an expansion, always a bigger embrace. So I'm proud and thrilled to be a part of a community for whom that is our mission. And so,
and tell me, what community are you a part of? Where are you a minister?
Yep. I'm in San Diego at San Diego First Church of the Nazarene, where I'm associate pastor there. And so I get to do, I basically say I'm a utility player who knows theology. Like, my job is like to do a little bit of everything, like maybe fix the broken toilet, but also be like a social worker, and then also be a cultural navigator, and maybe preach sometimes. You know, it's just, it's all over the place. I oversee young adult ministry. I oversee social justice education, what we would call like compassionate ministry partnerships. Compassionate ministry is kind of Nazarene lingo for the real hands-on practices, the stuff that we do that involves our, engages our hearts, our heads, our hands, in looking at what needs to be addressed in the world around us, like right here, literally in the city around us. So when you ask the kinds of things that we're involved in, we're learning about the border region that we live in. And we're recognizing that whether you cross the border all the time or not, you're a borderlander because you live here. And immigration being one of the issues of a borderlander, but certainly trade and economics, certainly worker rights, human trafficking across the border, that this border life, and just the fact that our friends and neighbors have been living and moving across the border for a really long time. So getting educated about what it means, what it represents to, what it means for you to live here, what that represents. We have a tremendously large homeless population of people, living on the street here because the weather's nice. And so advocating for fair policies, getting involved at macro and micro and everywhere in between levels is super important to our community. Being very, very careful with the charitable giving that the church does, but being mindful that we are giving out as a church. We don't think we're the only solution here. We're not really trying to reinvent the wheel. And so that allowing, giving, and keeping care to like protect those to keep a fund going so that we can pivot and respond, whether that's fires up north, or that's the migrant caravan to the south of us, or that is supporting a refugee tutoring center in the neighborhood of City Heights, so run by people we trust and love. So
immigration is a really hot issue right now for a variety of different reasons. Yeah. And I'm not asking you to speak for the Church of the Nazarene, but just in your position there at San Diego First Church of the Nazarene, like, yeah, what do you do? Like, I think a lot of people see the very public voice of Christians being very anti-immigrant, of being, and I want to be even clear here. I was extraordinarily disappointed with a Nazarene person, not a minister, but a Nazarene person, Dr. James Dobson, who came out with statements that seemed to justify even the kind of detainment that people are experiencing. So the Nazarene Church, again, not Christians in general, not getting a great sort of reputation here. What's it like to be part of a generally considered conservative denomination living in San Diego? What's your life like? Where does that bump up against what you do? How does this matter? What do we need to know as people who may not even be Christians?
So when you bring up immigration, it's one of many kinds of things that could be brought up that is in this realm of like, it's a quote, it's a political issue, right? And how do we deal with politics in church? And there's all kinds of ways that different ministers might think about this and engage this. And so we take great care to recognize that, by virtue of our position, we hold authority in people's lives. They come and listen to us on Sundays, but also they meet with us to talk about everything from issues within their family to like larger crushing global issues and everything in between. So we recognize that there's great kind of power, and with power is like so much responsibility and potential danger to like influence or manipulate someone to think the way that we think. So we try to be really careful about that. But we also have to say that there are certain things that go on around us that the Bible, which is like this guiding set of stories and instruction for us, has quite a bit to say about. And immigration is one of those things. And consistently, so when I'm thinking about scripture, I'm not looking for like two verses that prop up my argument. I'm looking for big themes that would go across Old Testament scriptures, like ancient stuff and newer stuff based on the life of Christ and shortly thereafter. And no matter what your political view would be of whether people get to come into the U.S. and how they get to come here and how they get to stay here, whether they have to leave, if you're a Christian, what you kind of signed up for is paying attention to these big thematic things in the Bible. And I'm taking a long time to say this to just kind of set this up, that you cannot get away from. Take care of the foreigner.
I want to repeat what you just said, is that if you're Christian, you are signed up for the big thematic aspects of scripture.
I think so. And it would be like, it would be impossible. I want to say like literally impossible to say that this is not a massive theme of scripture, which is welcome, which is take care of the foreigner among you, which is you yourselves were once foreigners. Don't forget what that was like and show hospitality. Jesus himself was an immigrant, and not just like a spiritual sort of immigrant from heaven, but like literally had a death wish on him, and his family moved around to keep him safe, like to different countries, like literally an immigrant, a refugee, someone fleeing persecution. And I will just jump in here to say he also was a brown, Middle Eastern, non-Christian refugee. And so to sanitize immigration now as Christians and to divorce that from our faith or divorce that from our values it just isn't approaching it from a Christian perspective. It just isn't. And because we in my leadership of my church are convinced that this is one of those critical issues that scripture speaks of regularly, that Jesus addresses. And because if you boil all the message down, it is, you must take care of the needy among you. That is the call. Well, then we are going, then that is where we're going to speak into this. And that may look to people like, oh, we're getting political. I'm never going to tell you how to vote. And I'm never going to give you like a voter's guide with my opinions, but I will push my congregation to say, I'm not necessarily interested in your political view on what to do with the people seeking asylum. I am going to say, I'd like you to share your money. I'd like you to share your time. I'd like you to share your stuff, because there's almost 10,000 people 20 minutes from us who, for whatever reasons that we will probably never be able to access and touch, are needing something different, and they're desperate enough to leave their homes to find it. And they're in literally our vicinity, and we take care of the needy among us, because that's who we are. That's what we do.
This seems really powerful to me. Is it so far that really you and I suppose me too, we've said nothing really politically, that this isn't about what position to take, it's not how to deal with immigration on the larger issue. But what you're saying is that as a pastor, you're leading a community that if there is somebody that comes within your vicinity that is in need, and that they are suffering in some way, and that they are migrating here for reasons, that you have to give of your resources, of your time, and of your care to make sure that they are well cared for. Regardless of what you think any administration should do, you have an immediate responsibility to be a good neighbor.
Because loving God is loving the neighbor. I mean, it is essential. It is the crux of what it is to, again, like sign on, be on this team. Like when Jesus is challenged, like, what's the most important law? He said, well, it's written, love God with everything that you've got in you. But the second thing I'm going to tell you is exactly like the first, love your neighbor like yourself. In loving God, we're bolstered. We're like given the source of love to love our neighbor. And as when we love our neighbor, because God is love, we see the face of God in someone human. So it is, yeah. Like when we love God with all that we have, like we're connected to this source of love that gives us a greater love to love our neighbor. And when we love our neighbor, because God is love, we see the face of God in that neighbor and the cycle flows. There's really not even, I try when I talk to my people about this, there's not really like a separation of this. Like I'm going to travel to my love God land, and then I'm going to go travel to my love the neighbor land. Like it's the same land. Like it's same, but different. And so I think that's to go back to something I mentioned earlier, why a border tour kind of experience is so important for me, because it's awfully hard to animate or activate people when they're stuck in an ideology like these people are dangerous. And there's certainly people in my congregation, of course, who think people coming across the border are coming to A, steal our jobs. They're criminals running from something. They are going to harm me in some way. Well, if that's a ground in narrative, I can't just stand at the pulpit and preach and expect that people change. We gotta move them. Like it's about shifting your geography. Let's go look at something. Let's go talk to a few people. Let's talk to people who think differently. Let's go talk to Border Patrol agents who attend our church. And then let's go talk to people at the Casa del Migrante, which is a house across the border that takes care of people on the move, gives them refuge for a couple weeks while they're getting on their feet. And it's been holding people who've been deported, largely like people traveling southward, actually, than northward for the last, I'd say, like 50 years. So to go there and to listen to the story of somebody who's lived a very different life and experience, to take a crew of people, which I've been doing, to do some work at a detention center or do a drop-off of goods that are needed or do some shopping and tell some stories. It is exposure to the neighbor. It's listening to that neighbor that challenges the narrative, because it's certainly not logical that all these people coming across the border are coming to harm us and take our jobs. But it's very easy to believe that if you hear one story. So if we're going to challenge that narrative, let's hear some other stories that aren't that, that are a mom just like you, who you can connect with. And it makes you feel, what would I do if my child was in danger? I'd probably do the same thing. And to have 85-year-old people, I'm not making this up. I mean, I could tell you their names. Women, men going on a border tour and driving away saying, I didn't know. I had no clue what was happening in Honduras. Or, wow, that has, how sad for what's happened to them. Surely there's a better system than just kicking them out of the country, right? If they were brought here at one. You know, that's everything to me when that paradigm shifts, because then you're not dealing with an issue, you're dealing with people. And I'd say that is like, again, to go back to sort of like central Christian core values, is we see people.
You speak with emotion, not just for refugees, but for people from your church on their journey.
Totally. Totally. Because the stories break my heart. But then I also, like, my heart swells when I see my own people moving, right? Like growing, shifting, being willing, quite humbly, to say, I may have been wrong. I may have been wrong. I may not have had all the information. That's a pretty incredible place to be.
This is not a story of a historically liberal church who votes a certain way and who moves a certain direction. You're talking about really engaging people at a point where the gospel is actually asking people to change their behaviors. Politics aside, it's asking people to change their behaviors and to meet people and to see things in a certain way. And that's a regular practice of your church and part of your responsibilities there.
Totally. Yes. Yes. And, you know, the woman that I'm two of the women actually that I'm channeling from that border tour that were like, whoa, this is maybe, okay, this is bigger than I thought. This is more complicated. I'm like, it always is. Yes, you're right. This September, both women have signed up to go on a trip with a partner that we've partnered with for a long time, Healing Waters International. They provide water purification systems so people can have access to clean water, usually based at churches, not to get them in the church to attend, but because a church is a great, central, easy, always open place that in Latin America, particularly, is usually the center of the city. And so our church has helped to put another system in there. And we're going on what's called a vision trip, not a mission trip. So mission trips kind of carry with them connotations of let's go and impart onto people elsewhere what we think is great and not really listen to them and do our agenda and then walk, go home and feel good about ourselves.
Right.
And be grateful for all that we have, right? Like that, I mean, I'm kind of making a, you know, making light of it. But, and mission trips have been really influential for me, but they for good reason have, can have a bad rap. So this trip in particular is called a vision trip. And it's called that because it's a learning trip. So you're not installing the water system. You're not informing anything about it. You're not really attending much of anything, except you're going to go see this thing that you funded working. And you might meet some people who are working at this facility or be present for people coming to fill their water bottles, but just kind of watching, observing, listening, paying attention, and then go home and tell people what you saw. What's happening there? Why do people need water? What did you learn about water access? And two of those women from the border tour are going on this and both of them saying, well, this is not your normal kind of mission trip, but I'm going. And I'd like to think that it's because there's been those moments of growth that have come from moments of, I'm going to push you a little bit, but I'm going to push you to be and do what you said you wanted to be and what you wanted to do. I'm going to keep you accountable to that, just like I want you to keep me accountable to that, because that's who we are.
What I hear you saying, just to make that more specific, is what you're saying to them is, I'm pushing you because you signed up to be Christian, and I know, and you have relationships with them. So you're not just pushing your agenda, but you're saying, look, we've been friends and I'm your pastor and I know you want to be Christian. That's your thing. So I'm asking you to step up in this way and to learn what it means to be Christian in this moment.
Yeah. And you hired me to lead you in this way, like in this way, not this way, my way, this way of Jesus. So I'm doing what you asked me to do, and I'm going to ask you to do what you want, what you say you want to do.
I mean, part of why we're having this podcast, and the parts that I love the most is that we keep saying, yeah, it's probably more complicated than that. So whatever, you know, whatever sort of assumptions we begin with, like one of our rules is to turn assumptions into curiosities. We talk about loving other people and, after we get done sort of attacking love as an ideal, which, you know, at this point in the conversation with what we're talking about in this particular podcast, we can say, okay, enough. Like love is clearly not just an ideal unless you want it to be, unless you want to be exempt from actually practicing it. So we could be on that. There's actually ways to practice love. But once we get beyond that, when you do find ways of practicing love, for people that you think may be breaking the law or doing things that you think are ungodly, isn't this some kind of endorsement, and doesn't this encourage like awful behavior, and doesn't it put us at threat? Isn't love ultimately naive and putting us at risk?
Yeah. I guess such a good and big question, Doug. Perhaps it's naive. Perhaps it's putting at risk. Also, I'm not really responsible. I mean, I think this is a really important piece to get clear on. Like if there's somebody doing something that it might be quote ungodly or sinful or traditionally, you know, unwelcome, I don't know, looked down upon in traditional Christian communities or whatever. I'm not responsible for that person's behavior. I'm not tasked to change them. they are just like every single person, just like me, just like every beautiful part of nature, a creation of God, fully beloved, fully worthy of love, made in the image of God, as we would say. And so my job is to show love in what that looks like for that person. I got to know somebody to know what it looks like to love them, or else it is just this vague platitude. Mm. So if I have a dear one coming out to me, and my church has particular views on that, to love that person who's, let's say, breaking down in front of me, is no longer welcome in their family space, I've got to listen to their story and respond to the specifics that they're sharing with me, not slap on some church response or formulaic answer. I'm compelled to say, how do I show compassion? How do I step in and speak to an injustice that might be happening? How do I take care of your needs right now? How do I just stay and remain here with you? My responsibility is certainly, I'm thinking way too much of myself if my responsibility is that I have to like convert the criminal or the ungodly person into something different. That's God's work. So I just got to be really clear all the time. And that may be called naive, or some people might say that doesn't do anything, but I think I've lived in this long enough to see that love absolutely, absolutely changes everything.
We'll be right back.
You trust God, I think, is an assumption that I'm seeing in this conversation, but you trust the methodology of love too.
Yeah, I do, to do its work.
The hard question is, how do you do it? Like what makes this possible to do day after day? If you're a woman, you are a cis white straight Christian woman.
Yeah.
At a church that largely votes Republican, and I don't mean your individual church, I mean your the church denomination, is going to lean to the right, has a complex history of service to the poor, which really its origins favors the poor. And here you are saying, I need to love people that people I go to church with may have quite a bit of anger about. Mm-hmm. That the rhetoric, that there's quite a bit of anger. And my methodology, my choice, because of Jesus, is to double down on love.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
So how do you, like, how is that sustainable? How do you wake up in the morning? Mm-hmm. And how do you handle the hard? Imagine there's just a lot of hard days in that.
Yeah, there are. There definitely are. Goodness, there's like 85 different answers that come to me. So I'm trying to filter through them. I take it seriously because it's what I deeply believe and have experienced over the course of my lifetime, that this is a very simple piece of scripture, that God is love. And where love exists, there is God. That's the presence of God. So I'm not making this love up myself. And I think that is super, super critical for me in sustaining not just my work in Christian ministry, but just my life and the kind of person that I want to be, is that I've got to kind of get that posture or that order proper, which is that asking posture, that like surrendered open posture, like, God, fill me with love. Fill me with love and give me some of the things that are harder for me to find right now, like grace and patience and some of those outgrowth of love kinds of things. So it's being conscientious enough to connect to that source. And that, I think when I say that, that's kind of a big, vague thing. And I think that looks different for different people, and it looks different for different seasons of life, what that means. Connect, right?
Yeah, connect to that source is the thing you're saying is, yeah.
It's kind of, and like, it's
different for different people.
Yeah. I totally think so. And the amount of time that takes, or the form that takes, There's, I don't think there's a formula to that. But that soul level sort of orientation toward love and toward wanting to receive that love, so that you can be a conduit of that, like give that out. That feels real critical to me. Also, when you journey with people for the long haul, you see the stories of people being kind of coming back to life or being made new, or finding a home, connecting and loving relationships with other people. Those storylines, those are worth so much. And practically, when there's a big one like that, I take a rock and put it in a vase in my office, and the vase just keeps getting more and more full. So on really hard days, I'm like, ah, the vase. Don't forget, there's a lot of great stories.
I don't want to miss that either. So when you have a particularly like great moment with someone, you see
like an arc of a life sort of like change, right?
You actually go and get a rock and put it in your vase.
Yeah.
So the practice is to say, so can you send me a picture of your vase when we're done
talking? I will. And my office is decorated in my home too, but lots of just special moments. There is a dog going nuts out there. Just mementos and things in my office that are these stories of transformation, stories that represent people. I think too, because I am a cis, white, straight, Christian woman, it's really important to me to listen to stories of people in different categories than myself. Really important. And if I don't actually know someone, then like can take in the media, the writing, the movie making, the podcasting of people in different categories, that expands my ability to enter into a story, changes the way I love people.
Tucker, it's time for real talk. Can we go real talk now? You know, I've had a lot of conversations this week with people that one could actually even argue that that their faith is an expression of ethics. And that's a lot of what we've talked about. And I'm an ethicist, so it makes sense. But I'm also a spiritual director, and there's part of me, and I want to take a big risk here and just say, for a woman like you doing what you do, like, what's God doing in your life right now? Is this a live spirituality, or is this just an ideological position you hold? But yeah, but what if God is alive and transformation is possible, what is God doing with you?
Oh, that's like a really good and fun question. So over the last 8 months or so, I have been confronted with the fact that I struggle to be fully honest, to come like fully clean with God in prayer. And that's not like I have these dark secret habits in a corner of my life that I'm not willing to share. It's not really that. It's more like if I have a deep emotion or a deep longing, or am feeling like, oh, this feels really unfair, an aspect of my life, or a deep loss that I'm sad about, I had to come clean kind of like early last summer with the fact that I edit my prayers of raw, unreserved honesty to God, because I kind of know what like the good Christian girl thing to do is, or good Christian kid or person thing to do is, which is to say something like, so God, I would really love to have a partner at this point in my life. My job is pretty complicated. It's a very confidential job, and I'm a super extroverted, open book person. So I'd really love someone to just be like, I got you, and maybe have dinner waiting, you know? The more I get into this job, just the weirder the hours and the harder, heavier it is, along with how wonderful and joyful it really is too. Okay. So if I would bring to that to God in prayer, it would be like, God, it would be so nice to have a partner. But you know what, God, I know that you've got me. And no matter what happens in my life, I'm going to be grateful, because my life genuinely is really amazing. So thank you in advance for the life that I have. And I'm just telling you, it's okay if you don't grant me this. Okay. That's like such a cleaned up, safe way to, it's not me just being sort of all out gut level, like, I feel really lonely and sad, God. And I feel like I'm married to 33 different people depending who answers the phone tonight, will be like my spouse-ish tonight, but it's not the same person I'm talking to every day. And that feels pretty hard to maintain. And people keep moving away. And I'm really, really, really sad. That's a different kind of prayer. And that's a prayer that says, search me, God, know me, and just be with me. It's not asking God to even do anything necessarily. So God has been very clearly inviting me to just say it, just tell it like it is and trust that that's okay. I don't have to clean it up. And it has been an incredible and freeing place to live my life from.
Yep. What would you long for people listening to this podcast?
So, Doug, when you asked me to be a part of this, you used a word that we definitely underuse, precarity. What a great word, right? And I would love for anyone listening to this podcast that finds themselves in a bit of precarity, which I think if you're really living your life, you're going to be in precarious places. So, that we would be comfortable with holding this concept of holding both. That two things that seem like they could not be true, or two things that feel like they jam up against each other and don't make sense together, that we wouldn't opt for picking one or the other, that we would put our both hands together and say, well, both of these just do happen to be true. So I'm going to let both of them be in the room. I'm going to take my, you know, my utter frustration. Like I'm trying to come up with a specific, I'm having a time. You know, I will take that I cannot stand this person in my family's political view, and I will hold it alongside my other hand, which is, and dang it, I love that person so much. And I love their stories and the way that they make me laugh. And I don't have to ditch on them because I don't agree with who they voted for. But I also don't have to just ignore that they voted for someone because I think they're really funny and I love them, but that both could live together. That's a precarious place to be. We will mess up in that place, or we will falter. We will be too harsh or betray ourselves in that place. But at least we would be telling the truth that both things exist at the same time. So being more comfortable with gray or paradox and just living there and telling the truth about that. Like my paradox of my prayer life, which was, I love everything that there is about my life, and my singleness has brought me so much right along next to, and I'd also really love a partner, and both happen to be true. And I don't have to be like, it's cool. It's cool. It's cool. I don't need a partner. I'm fine. Or I'm so desperate without this partner. Where are they? I don't have to live in either of those places because neither of those is actually representative of me. So I would just love for your listeners to feel willing to hold both.
How does prayer make it possible to hold both? How does it change that? What does it do that makes holding, what does it mean to pray to God that makes some of the expected surprises sustainable and livable and practicable from day to day?
When I believe with everything in me that who I am talking to is the one who has like given me life and made me and made the world and is love, like is all and only love, then that's the safe person to be talking to. And so then when I speak with greater unreserved honesty, I hear myself in a different way than when I'm talking to you, even, who loves me so much, but who I still might be insecure with, or when I'm talking in front of my congregation and considering all the different things that they might be thinking about me at any given moment. It's a different sort of intimacy when I'm speaking to my maker. And what I think is totally and only love. so it helps me see myself differently.
What is the most beautiful thing God has, that you would say that God has made clear to you recently?
Yeah. So that's the other part of it, right? That God is also speaking to me. And so prayer is like this attentiveness. It's walking through the world, waiting to be surprised by what God is showing me. But God has spoken to me recently, and this is super recent, like hot off the press from just some things that I've been a part of lately, is this like very deep deep soul level affirmation that I really love and am good at and have made for this work that I do. And it's not necessarily connected to San Diego First Church of the Nazarene, though I adore my congregation. It's not about like my paycheck. It's more that continuing to remind people whose we are and what we said we were going to do and be is like something that gives me life and I can wake up for and do every day. And the affirmation that I'm hearing from God is, and you're good at it. So keep going, keep going. And be a little bolder in what you have to say, because I asked you to do it. I got you. That's been the message as of late.
As a practice here, we like to appreciate, I have to say, and you know, you've been a friend for a long time, and I hope you've heard some of these things before, but what, you know, we started by talking about precarity, but I know that, you know, there is a way in which you hold complexities of your friends' lives together the way that some people can't hold complexities in their own lives. And for me, whether it has been artist or distant or intellectual, or when I was your pastor or a Christian or a person full of doubt, whether any of those things have appeared, that none of them have ever been a shock to you. And so I think about your persistence in just making efforts to be near me, your thoughtfulness in when you send me a birthday gift, especially like for major events, like my 40th birthday, you weave together a narrative of my whole life. And the best that I could do is really hope that in some partial way that somebody is tuckering you and holding your complexity and letting you know the beauty of it. I think one of the things that was clear to me is that talk to Tucker, because it doesn't matter what issue we start on, we're going to get to the heart almost immediately. And that she will say something beautiful that people need to hear. That's something I can always count on, because even in our small conversations, that you recognize things that are beautiful. And to me, part of the reason that I am Christian is not just because I think that it's somehow true in a way that is exactly diagrammable, but because it's true, beautiful, and good. And you always so fill in the beautiful and good in ways that so that is actually everywhere, but you just do it so distinctly well that it's compelling to me to want to stay Christian and wake up and to try again tomorrow to do exactly what you're doing. I'm glad you are where you are. I'm glad you're my friend. I'm glad you're a Nazarene pastor. I'm glad you're a woman. And I don't know what I would do without you. So I have to.
Totally going to cry. That was such a beautiful, beautiful gift you just gave me. Thank you.
That's what I was fishing for. I was hoping if you could sob a little before we called it a night, that, you know, listeners might go, wow, that was really powerful.
That was really powerful.
There you have it. A glimpse into the life of the Reverend Melissa Tucker, Associate Pastor at San Diego First Church of the Nazarene. It's not a life most people would choose. Quite frankly, it's complicated. But what she does with it seems to be quite extraordinary, quite beautiful, and life-giving to her. Somehow she makes it through the precarity because she does it with passion and with love, and because what she does ultimately is what makes her heart burn. I need to hear more stories like this, so please, if you can subscribe and take just a little time and review, it would be so helpful for us to keep going and to connect with other people. Also, don't forget to visit us at theheartburn.net. Thank you for listening. It's important. My name is Doug Harrison, and this is The Heartburn.